Mark Wahlberg was the shift manager on that fateful day in Black Friday, Tickle Me Elmo. In honor of Deepwater Horizon, what news event during your lifetime should Mark Wahlberg's next hero-making project be?
I'm Katie Rich, and I think he should play one of the guys who stole the suitcases that contained the bombs that would have been more bombs in New York City after the Chelsea bomber, because he's a lunkhead who saves the day.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I would like him to play Balloon Boy's father in the saga of Balloon Boy, because I will forever remember that afternoon I thought we were going to see a dead boy's corpse tumble out of a weather balloon.
I'm Matt Patches, and the truth is I probably don't want to see Mark Wahlberg appear in any more real-life stories. He's done enough for this country. But I would like to see him go in some radical direction where he brings his what-if story of saving the day on 9/11 to screen. Is that horrific? I don't know. That's a good story. Look it up.
I'm David Ehrlich. I think this might be the hardest question that has ever been asked. There are at once way too many answers and too few. Patches, I think I remember that vividly. And I think I'm going to play a rare card on this podcast and just say what Patches said.
Oh, my God.
I think we, as much as nobody needs to see that movie, we all need to see that movie.
I see it as like a Kirk Cameron movie, but Mark Wahlberg's in it.
Sure.
Yeah, it's like they could call it Remember Me Too,
it will be the
and we'll just pick
Bastards.
Up right where we left off.
Yeah. It'll be the Inglourious Bastards of 9/11.
Oh, my word.
It'll be great.
I hope we live to see the Inglourious Bastards of 9/11. I guess that's kind of Remember Me.
That's the title.
Remember Me or Inglourious Bastards of 9/11?
Inglourious Bastards.
Inglourious Bastards of 9/11.
Perfect.
Oh, gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 138. It's Tuesday, September 27th, and on this day in 1982, production began on Never Say Never Again, which, according to this information I'm being fed, is a James Bond film that starred Sean Connery and also Kim Basinger, but it was not produced by Eon Films and therefore is not Bond canon. And
damn right, I could talk about it for like another 30 minutes if you guys want.
It was also the only Bond that was reliably on television in between Bond marathons when we were growing up. So I've seen that one many times.
He's so old in that one. Now, no wonder Charlie doesn't like it. Charlie's ageist.
That's true. He's very young and therefore thinks everyone should be. guys, how about reviews this week? Do we have anything good?
We're pulling it up.
We definitely will after talking about Mark Wahlberg's 9/11 story for sure. But this week, I'm not so sure.
it seems like we do have a few.
Oh, boy.
A few reviews. We have three, in fact. They're all pretty short, so let's just read them all. The first, from Most Interesting Second AC, calls us the Carol of podcasts and naturally gives us as many stars as one can when talking about Carol. This podcast is a great listen for cinephiles, indie producers, or closet Oscar fans. Listeners, you will soon vastly prefer to listen to those hosts review film festival picks much more than going outside or talking to people. Talking to people is the worst. Here's what you should know about the host. Patches, what does he know? Does he know things? Let's find out. David, my fellow Columbia grad, is naturally my spirit animal. Like coffee, beer, and Pride and Prejudice, David Ehrlich takes some learning to love, but he has become my favorite film critic, and everyone should listen to everything he says, except when it comes to Skyfall, which is garbage. Dave wow. Seven is instantly lovable. No stranger to graphic novels, video games, sci-fi, or fantasy. I look forward to running into Dave Seven at an upcoming Comic-Con. Please host a panel next year. I also respect the hell out of him for not seeing MI5 in theaters and promoting Going Clear. Dave Seven makes it all happen, and you can blame him for the music choices and wonky clown horn at the beginning of each episode. Listening to Katie is like talking to a friend who knows a lot more than you. She is who we all want to be. Jordan is the worst. Run away from any podcast he is guest starring on. Thanks, everyone, in parentheses, except Jordan. You are the Carol of podcasts.
Jordan hasn't been on since the Michael Bay Benghazi
movie,
right?
No, but he left one hell of an impression.
Yeah, that was enough,
sure
apparently.
Did.
Can come on once a year, and we'll feel the shockwaves until the calendar rolls around. Second review, 5 out of 10 stars, although still 5 stars technically, from J. Ron Hubbard. I love this podcast, especially the opening. Peter Sellers is a treasure who should never be forgotten. I've been turned on to more excellent television and movies through this podcast than I thought was possible. I generally identify with Joanna's tastes when they let her out of the basement to join, but I love Dave Seven's and Katie's suggestions as well. One complaint. Actually, two. Why can't you guys all sound as good as Dave Seven or Joanna? Can we chip in for some better microphones and recording software? And I vote for a mute button that the ladies get to use exclusively so they can stop being talked over by you know who you are.
I think that should be a Skype feature, actually.
Keep up the great work. Mansplaining
Skype button.
You guys are all great.
I don't sound shitty.
J. Ron Hubbard, we all have really good microphones. I don't know why Matt and I sound so shitty all the time, but I suppose we do. Whatever the problem is, the microphones aren't the cause, but we're always looking to improve, so thank you. And the last one today is from Best Podcast About Movies, so that's actually the name of the review. It's from Dr34MV3IL. Who says, I genuinely believe that Pixar is a better studio and makes better movies than Studio Ghibli. God, I hope David is on this episode, because the only reason I'm leaving this review, other than to overtake Billions, obviously, was to hear David Ehrlich say that sentence out loud.
Anyway, now you're someone's ringtone.
Love the podcast, and sorry I couldn't be as genuine or heartfelt as some of the better reviews I've heard over the years. You really are the best movie podcast around, and I hope you continue to keep up the great work. Thank you, Dr. Unpronounceable. Your review was just as good as any we've gotten. And I did read that in real time for the first time. So
I do think that tricking you into saying something is a really good incentive to get people to leave a review. So leave a review, including a sentence you want to hear David say, and he has to say it. It's the law.
the law is in quotes.
Yeah, it's internet law.
But yeah, read reviews. That's what we call the call. Leave it.
So for this week's tidbit, we are going to be talking about a filmmaker by the name of Werner Herzog. And we'll get to why we're talking about him.
We like him.
Well, you know, a little bit of backstory. I, once upon a time, before it was cool, mind you, wrote my college undergrad thesis about the ecstatic truth in the films of Werner Herzog. And the reason that I chose the subject beyond a general interest is because at that time, there was very, very, very little critical writing about him. This was before, for whatever reason, sort of in the wake of Grizzly Man, he became popular. And his popularity, his newfound popularity outside of the arena of movies, is what we're sort of going to be talking about in this segment. But I had been fascinated by him and his philosophy regarding movies, and also his penchant for self-mythologizing, and he just seemed as far away personality-wise and experience-wise from my life as one could get, and so I gravitated towards that. And I've always been a big fan. Aguirre, The Wrath of God, one of my favorite movies. Fitzcarraldo. And a number of his docs are near and dear to my heart as well. Recently, he's back. He's like back. He's prolific and never really felt like he went away, because he really ingrained himself in the texture of our culture and our vernacular. I mean, Werner Herzog, something happened, again, after Grizzly Man, which is a wonderful movie, where he popped as this, as a more meme than man, really. He became, his gift for self-mythology, which has been a streak of his that has been alive and well with him from the beginning. You know, there are reasons that, in addition to the evident insanity of what he was doing, I mean, there are reasons that you know about, even casual moviegoers, A, recognize his voice, but B, know about him pulling a boat over a mountain in Fitzcarraldo, or a hill in reality, or you know, there are other stories that fall down from there that are maybe less popular about him.
Taking a bullet during an interview.
That was a major landmark in the ascension of his
memeification.
Yeah, absolutely.
When was that? Then,
I don't know, maybe like 2006 or 7, I
yeah,
would say.
Yeah, earlier 2000s. But didn't he also save
Joaquin Phoenix from a car? He did. And my all God. Of a sudden, like him going, filming La Soufriere and going to an island where a volcano was imminently going to erupt, sort of pales in comparison. But this
cut to later in this millennium, and he is a co-star in Penguins of Madagascar, the bad guy in Jack Reacher, and a cameo in Rick and Morty this last season.
I mean, this is a guy who was the king of, like, an innate master of branding long before it was widely accepted that this is something that individuals needed to do for themselves in order to succeed in this sort of digital age. This is a guy who this came to very naturally and has always excelled at it. And once the internet came along and discovered him, it was sort of a match made in heaven, at least so far as his meme-ness and popularity are concerned. Some could argue that his filmmaking has suffered a little bit during those years. Whether or not they have anything to do with one another is unclear. And his narrative filmmaking, the fiction movies that he's made, have always been a little bit spottier. I mean, I cited several of them as my favorite of his movies, and others that I didn't mention are also in that league. But when Herzog falls in his face, it's almost invariably with a fiction film. He knows what he's doing and doesn't deviate too much from the plan for the most part when it comes to nonfiction filmmaking, which is really where he quite literally allows his voice to become part of the equation, and where is sort of only helping his brand beyond that. And his fiction films tend to be a lot less popular in a lot of metrics than his documentary stuff. But he actually hasn't made a documentary in a number of years since he made Into the Abyss about inmates on death row. He made a PSA about texting and driving that was very effective as far as PSAs go. And that was sort of advertorial content. And now...
Explain what you mean by advertorial content.
Well, those were sponsored by whoever they were sponsored by. I can't remember. But it was not like he self-generated this idea. He was like, I'm going to make a film about not texting and driving. He was paid by someone to... Yeah,
I think it was AT&T who did the texting and driving.
And so... You know, and you know, there was like the Werner Herzog reads children's books and, like, you know, Werner Herzog this and that and everything. And he really just sort of, I don't know if this affected him as a person at all, but he became, as we said, more of a meme than anything else. And now that he is back with a small flotilla of new movies, it's interesting to, one of which Katie just saw today or recently and sort of invited us to have this conversation about it. And we'll get there in a second. He is back in the news, and it's interesting to sort of look at where he is and how far he's come since the last time he had a number of movies. And so recently he had at Sundance this year a movie called Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World, which is what Katie just watched. And that is sort of following in the lead of the stuff that he made for AT&T, and it's much more sneaky about this, but it is essentially paid content. I mean, I don't think that there are too many restrictions on what he could do, but there's something about that movie, and in a second we'll hear from Katie, see if she feels differently, but there's something about that movie that feels a little bit perfunctory, that feels a little bit on rails for him, that just doesn't have that same sense of curiosity that I think fuels all of his best documentaries. And it turns out that the documentary was the idea of and paid for a company called NetScout Systems that was looking to put a brand name filmmaker behind a project that would not explicitly advertise their products. And the movie doesn't. It doesn't, like, you know, you don't feel like you're watching an ad, but would just sort of lend credence to and explore a lot of the ideas that their business is founded upon.
And it certainly does, because it's about every aspect of the internet you could possibly dip your toe into for 2 seconds.
And this was after his Robert Pattinson, Nicole Kidman, sort of like Lawrence of Arabia style fiction movie, Queen of the Desert, played in Berlin and bombed and still has yet
to come out
here.
Yeah.
Nope.
Oh my God.
Not here at least. And he was then at Telluride at the Werner Herzog Theater because he is an institution at Telluride. I went on the Saturday morning there and saw it with Herzog in the Herzog Theater, his new documentary, Into the Inferno, which you can read my review of on IndieWire, and I liked very much. It feels like a direct sequel to Encounters at the End of the World, which is a lovely documentary made in like 2007, I think. And it's not the most hard-hitting documentary he's ever made, but it's very much vintage Herzog and doesn't really feel like he's lost a step. But then in Toronto and also at Fantastic Fest, he was there with, in addition to Into the Inferno at Toronto, a fiction film called Salt and Fire, and it falls into, I think, the most reflexively the least interesting category that any movie possibly can, so far as I'm concerned, which is an eco-thriller. The words eco-thriller are just so
also
toxic.
About volcanoes.
Yeah,
I'm sure they have fire.
Yeah, I'm sure the projects had something to do with one another. One spawned the other, but and it has been roundly just savaged critically. And this is someone again who spent a significant chunk of their time in college, at least, and afterwards thinking about Herzog and writing about Herzog and enjoying Herzog, could not even be bothered to go see it at Toronto. So that's sort of where we are with Herzog right now. He's in a strange state so far as his, he's an older guy, and filmmakers who have been in the mix for this long, they're not often churning out their best work. I think someone like Martin Scorsese is probably a rarity. But Katie, what did you think of Lo and Behold?
Well, so, I mean, I haven't seen nearly as much Werner Herzog as you have, and watching Lo and Behold, which I kind of just jumped into not really knowing that much about, I wasn't really thinking about how it compares to what he's been making or what he's made in the past. And I do see, like, I didn't know it was sponsored content. I had no idea NetScout was involved in watching it. I don't think the name NetScout is ever mentioned. And I found it interesting. He has interviews with people like Elon Musk and people who work in robotics, and it's talking about, the various elements of the internet, from internet addiction to how solar flares could wipe the whole thing out, and how there are, robots trying to learn how to be people. And it's perfunctory, I think, is maybe a fair word for it, in that it's kind of going through all these different elements of something, and it's not as meditative as some of his other films have been. But I would rather have someone like Werner Herzog making this than basically any other documentarian. Like, if he's going to be making paid content, and good for him, he's making some money making documentaries, like, have his voice and his kind of exploratory angle on things to also teach me how the internet works. I like that combination. I feel like he works well for something like this.
I think a lot about Alex Gibney and Morgan Spurlock, who seem to get hired for documentaries like this about other topics, obviously, and what Herzog's voice does to a movie, or at least his eye and his observations. I want to hear Werner Herzog, and not because he's a meme, but because he is a poetic speaker, say things like orcish mage and that sort of thing, of talking about Warcraft, instead of Morgan Spurlock talking of, injecting himself into his movies.
I don't think there's any debate over who I would rather see make a movie about literally anything.
But by the way, Morgan Spurlock has a new movie out about rats coming soon at the interview.
And I also want to see, Herzog, hold on Elon Musk after he talks about building colonies on Mars, and kind of watch Musk squirm for a second and, making you think more about what he said than an, average documentary would. Like, he makes choices that make it interesting.
Right.
Well, I think his memification allows him to a certain degree of authority that people like Morgan Spurlock, I think, have squandered really early on. But I sort of see a Werner Herzog documentary. Like, I kind of know what that's going to be, and I've started aligning that with fact, like I align Ken Burns with fact. So they're totally different voices, but they're authoritarian because I've been able to see them, sort of grow between different documentary projects. I don't know what fiction says about that, though.
Well, it's so interesting because, what you're saying about the authority of his voice, so much of his appeal and the movies that he makes is predicated on not necessarily believing the accountant's truth, as he would call it, of everything that he says.
Right, and that, the ecstatic truth, stuff that which we talked about early on when we're getting to know each other as film fans is, I think, part of what makes him so trustable. Because if someone's coming out and saying, no, here are the facts, I ate only McDonald's and this is going to kill everybody, then when, that breaks down, you're like, huh. But if any, Herzog film breaks down, I'm like, I'm glad I went on that exploration with that guy, because that we really watched that fall apart together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if I would call Herzog an authority on any subject that he sticks his nose into. And yet, but he is something. He's a spirited guide, I suppose. He's the only person who could go to I think he goes to CMU. He goes to Carnegie Mellon to observe
robots who play soccer.
People, yeah. And he asks the one kid who's, designing and programming these robots to play soccer if he loves them. And I was very affected by that moment, because that's not a question that anyone making a tech-oriented documentary would do, and that was the right question to ask, because this kid was knocked backwards and professed his love for the robot. Yes, he does love it.
It's worth mentioning that Into the Inferno has not a co-director, as it originally seemed he might be billed, but very much as a main character who is not Werner Herzog, who is an authority on volcanoes, a volcanologist whose name is Clive Oppenheimer, who is a the movie sort of uses B-roll that Oppenheimer shot of him palling around with Herzog on the set of on the top of a mountain of Encounters at the End of the World. And that is what started their working relationship and led to this. And that is the best scene in Into the Inferno. But
he does have a nose for badass authorities. There's a woman in Lo and Behold, too, who is this. What does she do? Katie, you've seen it the most recently.
It's like space exploration.
Yeah, she's talking about how like the sun will destroy us or something. Yeah. And she's just a total badass about it because she's like, we got to get off this planet. We got to go to Mars now. Fuck you all. Let's go.
She's got amazing tattoos.
Oh, yeah. She is a badass. But Herzog is good at that. But there's something about Lo and Behold that still feels like a parody of Herzog. Hmm. And I'm trying to put my finger on what it is or if there's something about his gamification.
Well, can he avoid feeling like a parody of himself at this point? Like, because that voice is so iconic. Like, isn't it hard for him to kind of escape that shadow?
I don't know if
that intentional where he got... He became a hired gun, and he reached for something, and then in the edit, he's like, meh. So you didn't get the full subconscious stamp of endorsement.
Maybe he just can't go as deep as he wants to. Like, he's delivering a Werner Herzog film with the beats that you need, and the joy is there on the surface, but no portion of Lo and Behold can go deep enough into the jungle, to use a... kind of hurts.
Well, he's also trying to make a film about the way the internet has affected humanity, like pretty early on into our lives with the internet. Like, there is in a way, there's like, you can't get to the bottom of it.
That's true. He's making a film about an ancient civilization while it's taking place on some level.
Basically.
He wants to be looking back, but he has to look forward. And maybe that's not his strongest suit.
I don't know. I kind of liked his commentary over Kanye West's famous video that Joe Amato got him to do.
Well, this is what a lot of people have taken. There's been a lot of criticism over the string of interviews that have come out with Herzog because he's been talking about film school and people have been trying to kind of lead him down this anti-film school bent, even though he's been doing masterclass videos and he's been running his own rogue film school. And then I think The Verge got him to talk about Pokemon Go, which had a lot of raised eyebrows and still made headlines, which is amazing, right? Like Facebook Trends will pick up a Werner Herzog story about Pokemon Go.
It's been a slow summer, huh?
Yeah. But that's when, I mean, maybe we're leading Werner Herzog down the self-parody route, and he is able to preserve himself in the films, which is kind of miraculous. He can be cut off.
Or like David said, he understands branding better than anybody, and that's how he keeps getting money to make movies, because they want that Werner Herzog stamp, and he keeps himself in the public eye by talking about Pokemon Go.
Yeah, go. Or they're like on the Rick and Morty commentary for the episode that he's in, they talk about how he actually wanted to like keep contributing while he was like in the vocal booth. So he was just like super enthusiastic and... You know, if he has an opinion, why not throw it into the ether and see what it rebounds back?
The man likes
to
work.
I want to know what he thinks about Pokemon Go. And now that I know, I want to know what he thinks about Stranger Things. Because then we'll have the whole year covered.
God damn it, Dave.
Hey guys, what's Fleabag and why do you want me to watch it?
Well, I the other day I learned about this thing called television, it's hard to explain, but it's no longer really means the actual television. What we call television, sometimes there's on television, and sometimes like the show Fleabag, which premiered on television, I believe, in the UK on BBC Three.
Oh, on actual television, in your living room.
I cannot figure out how to even put on my television if I wanted to here because it's on Amazon Prime and I don't have their like stupid box.
You
paying for Amazon Prime is probably equivalent to getting a TV license. So really, everybody's paying for this about equally.
Yeah, I pay for Amazon Prime.
You don't have a Blu-ray player that has Amazon Prime on it? We'll have to talk after this.
Oh, maybe it's on my PlayStation 4. I don't know.
Really?
Anyway, the point is, we're going to set up Fleabag briefly and then revisit it down the line, because what you're about to hear are two dudes enthusiastically, at least enthusiastically on my part, endorsing a show that is very, very much about being a woman. And Katie has yet to watch it. And we are going to check back and have a longer section for when she does.
Yeah. And maybe also talk about Easy on Netflix, if people are catching up on that.
Maybe. But this segment that we're about to do very quickly is a invitation to anyone out there to watch Fleabag, so you can follow along with us when we talk about it later. But Fleabag is a 6-episode British comedy about a woman. It stars and is written by a woman named Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who wrote a play of the same name, and that was at the Edinburgh something or other festival. Fringe Festival. I just think of the New York Fringe Festival, which is, I don't think, as prestigious. Has adapted it, and it's 6 episodes. She's essentially a chronically single, miserable woman living in London who thinks that her sister is perfect and is on again and off again with a boyfriend. It sounds very trite. She, like, runs a coffee shop that she started with her best friend who...
That's not a spoiler. That's not, well, that's the first episode.
We learn in... Not a spoiler? Okay. Well, we learn in the first episode that the scenes with the friend are flashbacks. The friend is dead. And her death weighs heavily on our main character, who's, I believe her only name that we know.
I don't recall that, but on IMDb, she's listed as Fleabag. Who knew?
She's listed as Fleabag. But it is, and she talks a lot. She breaks the fourth wall all the time. She talks to the camera sort of in scene. Like, she'll make asides while other conversation is going on quickly to the camera. All of this, if I were listening to someone say these words that are coming out of my mouth now, sounds terrible. I assure you, by the, like, fourth minute of the first episode, where she is dumped because her boyfriend finds her masturbating to one of Barack Obama's speeches in the middle of the night, this will be a little bit off the beaten path for what you imagine in your head when you hear me describe it. It is singularly bitter and funny. And
it's very raunchy. You have to prepare yourself for extended jokes, and I hope you enjoy them because they're amazing.
Yes. It tells a... Patches was saying off show that it really could have been a film. I think it probably runs somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 hours and 40 minutes if you play it all together. And the story, it's not at all episodic. I mean, small characters who show up in the first episode appear in the fifth and sixth, and it's all sort of interconnected. It's all clearly very well thought out from the get-go, which I guess is the advantage of doing a 6-episode limited run thing. It has the emotional coherence of a feature film. Everyone in it is so wonderful, particularly Phoebe Waller-Bridge is great, and her Olivia Colman as her godmother, who is referred to emphatically as a cunt upon her first introduction, and ends up becoming one of the most, like, savagely, like, passive-aggressively cruel characters I can ever remember seeing, is wonderful. And I just thought this was so strong and, like, had such a great sense of identity and spoke, as best I could tell, as a sort of, you know, cisgender heterosexual man.
And hasn't been dating for a while. I think that's key, too. I mean, we see so many movies, or at least maybe I do, at Sundance that are just about, like, relationships and what it's like to be a millennial and that kind of thing. And this is about that, and it nails it. Yeah, I've been there. Show me what else you got.
And you're like, bitch, I lived
perspective, it. And it makes this kind of manic dating. I think it's very, very funny.
Did you like the show?
She's wonderful, and she's... No, I have not. So I'm 5 out of 6.
But you haven't seen the last episode.
I just think it's her perspective, and she has the office level stare at the camera and tell us everything, sometimes with a quip and sometimes without. And she's just brilliant at doing that fourth wall breaking shtick. And just the raunchiness of the sex talk and the dating talk and her encounters with men. I don't know. And some are awful men, some are wonderful men that she breaks. I just love the perspective. So, not much like it out on TV if you watch TV or just on your TV. I don't know. Where are we going with that? We'll just keep calling it TV.
Just quick.
We never settled that.
Quick aside, I just keep thinking of Catastrophe, which is another British show that made its way to Amazon. Are they like specializing in bringing British shows?
Well, Netflix
over here?
I guess
Netflix has Black Mirror.
I imagine that those two things you just mentioned are not unrelated.
Oh, that Amazon saw Netflix get Black Mirror and was like, shit.
Although,
and is like, what could we pick up from BBC Three?
Yeah.
Fleabag is just an acquisition. I'm not 100% sure about that, but.
I just think about when like a boyfriend in college like introduced me to like illegal downloads of Spaced, and that was how you found British shows 10 years ago, and now they're just all over the place. It's a great time to be alive.
Yeah, I thought Fleabag was better than anything that Amazon... I haven't seen Transparent, so that's a huge disqualification.
Oh, Transparent's wonderful.
But it's better than anything else that I've seen. Any original shows...
You need to watch
Catastrophe. ...on Amazon, certainly. I think on Netflix that I've seen. It's a lot stronger than Easy, which I also have some good things to say about, which Joe Swanberg made and which we'll talk about at a later date. But Fleabag, it's on Amazon Prime. Go watch it, and then we will all reconvene... either next week or the week after, sometime in the imminent future, and we'll let Katie lead that discussion, and we'll talk about Fleabag with you.
So, just hours ago, I was in Austin, Texas, attending Fantastic Fest. Was I the first person on this podcast to attend Fantastic Fest, which many of our listeners have probably heard about? Beaming from Austin as this kind of mecca of genre film taking place at the Alamo Draft House.
Unless we count Jordan, everyone's favorite guest.
We don't count Jordan.
Yeah.
Fuck that guy.
Okay.
So I just got back. That's why my voice is very hoarse. Last night, I attended an Itch.io concert, which Dave previously described in our Stanley Film Fest episode from eons ago.
Yeah, how was that?
It was incredible. For those who don't know, Itch.io is this satanic themed marching band that they kind of dress up in what do they dress up as, Dave? They look kind of like Daft Punk.
Sort of like black luchadors / Daft Punk / gypsies.
Yeah, and they carry around
they carry around
like giant drums and giant keyboards, and they run through the audience and push you over, and everyone's moshing, and it's I was a sweaty mess, and I was headbanging, and that is not something I usually do. But the drums were loud, and the vibe was right, and the satanic, the Satan horns were in the air. So it was a good time, and that's why I can barely talk. But I'm back from Fantastic Fest, and people sounded curious about what went down. What do you guys want to know? I mean, a lot of the movies that played at Fantastic Fest actually premiered at Toronto. There are a few gems that I would describe as very Fantastic Fest that I can talk
which
about.
Which means...
But... Yeah, which ones are those? Let's start with those.
What do you guys think a Fantastic Fest movie is? Because we've talked about the festival a little from afar.
So I guess here's what I've gleaned from Fantastic Fest movies. The ones that really pop there aren't necessarily going to be good movies, but they're movies that I don't want to miss for a specific reason, be it the people involved or the crazy idea that someone actually took this premise and made it a movie.
Yes,
that you probably ought to see at least in a crowded theater or in at least a room full of your friends to scream with.
Exactly. You definitely want a loud crowd, maybe a drunk crowd, which the Draft House can certainly provide you with. And I saw the most Fantastic Fest movie I could have imagined,
side. The Dwarf.
Yes,
right?
The Dwarves Must Be Crazy. This movie is... here's the summary on the Fantastic Fest website. A Thai village of little people is attacked by evil, butt-munching, fart-tracking Krause spirits, a.k.a. floating heads with attached intestines, in this slapstick horror comedy. And when they say slapstick, they mean like stooge-level... poke you in the eyes, slide whistle, everyone's farting on each other, and these floating heads with attached intestines are exactly that. They're evil spirits that will put shit in their these little people's mouths. It is insane. It's insane.
Do you think that Fantastic Fest actually watched the movie first, or was the premise, the log line, just enough for them
Funny
to program it?
Funny you should say this. The movie is an hour and a half, and it's a disaster. It's a really, really bad movie because, for some reason, it keeps repeating itself. This is a movie where it's kind of like Time Bandits. So it's like six dwarves are going on an adventure, And it has that Time Bandits vibe until it continually repeats itself over and over and over again. They get lost in the woods. They come back. They're poking each other in the eyes. They're climbing. They're trying to form a pyramid. Oh, they can't get the thing in the nest. It's so stupid. Oh, no. Here, and then halfway through the movie, the floating head intestine monsters are replaced by grown men in vulture wings. It's just whatever. It makes absolutely no sense, but it keeps repeating, and it is so laborious. But the first 30 minutes are an achievement in the weird. And according to my intel from Fantastic Fest, only 30 minutes were sent to the Fantastic Fest programmers, and they just put it in the festival anyway.
Wow.
And it would not surprise me to learn that they completed 30 minutes and they were scrambling to complete the other 60.
But this is the only festival in the world where that could be used as a selling point.
Absolutely.
Like that could be a positive.
I would not recommend this movie based on quality. I would recommend this movie based on watching it at 11 p.m., guzzling beer, and having a great time. It is insane. There's dance numbers. There is peeing on each other. This movie has it all. And that is a Fantastic Fest.
You sound like
movie.
A Stefan. Yeah.
The new club. But then on the other side of the spectrum, I think a Fantastic Fest movie can be a genre film, probably a horror movie that is barely going to get released, probably IFC Films. And one comes to mind. I saw this movie, A Dark Song. Did this play at Toronto, David? Do you know?
No, I don't think so. I had not
if
heard
it
of
did,
it prior
yeah,
to Fantastic
It was not
Fest.
One of the standouts, and I don't think I had heard nothing about it. But it has the DNA of Kill List, of Breaking the Waves, of Weird Occultist. I'm trying to think of a good satanic-themed movie. But it's about a woman who, for reasons I will leave a mystery, spoiler-free here, because people should go in with as little knowledge as possible, but she is basically hiring someone to complete a satanic ritual for her so that she can cross over and speak to someone on the other side. And you would think that this could have a very like Conjuring-esque tone. You know, James Wan could make this movie. But instead, it's made by this Irish filmmaker with the utmost control, and the vibe is deeply unsettling. The imagery is terrifying, and not just when they're kind of steeping into black magic, but when this woman and the guy that she's hired, and the guy is the guy from Sightseers. I'm not familiar with the actress. I'll have to look her up, and if people want to know, they can tweet at me, but or look it up. But the guy from Sightseers plays this man who is steeped in the knowledge of the other realms, and he's going to basically, for her to complete this ritual, she has to starve herself. She has to sleep underwater for periods of time. She has to just go to the end of the earth and back in order to break her soul. And you can imagine how that could be very silly or very intense. And this movie goes towards the intense. And I thought it was wonderful, at least at 11 p.m. when I was drunk.
I feel like every review should.
That is not completely true. I was very aware of this movie while it was happening and getting under my skin. But yeah, that would be the other category of Fantastic Fest.
I have a question about Fantastic Fest, which I find every year I feel like I have an increasing desire to go. It looks fun. I think, especially if you're only there for like 72 hours, like
that's exactly what
that
I did,
was.
Yeah.
I think that's probably like you're in, you're out. You live to tell the tale. Sounds fun. My feeling about Fantastic Fest, the devil's advocate, appropriately enough for this festival, in me at least, is saying that watching it unfold over Twitter, I can't think of any other film event that feels like people need to perform the fun they're having so loudly. It's like constantly. It's like, oh, someone's eating rats, and there's this contest, and like, oh, it's so crazy. Like, I just overheard this crazy thing, and then, like, it just seems like I don't know if I would have the energy to constantly sort of project the fun that I'm having at all times, which seems required.
Well, I think a lot of the legacy people who have been going to this for 12 years since the Draft House established this film festival feel really rooted in the Draft House success. So they broadcast it. You know, I was not tweeting that much about my fun having.
This was not directed at you necessarily.
No, I know.
It's more of a collective impression.
Well, exactly. So people want it to emit fun and for it to reign supreme in this in this world. But it's certainly not a film festival. It is just a festival that has films. It is a... It's trying to be extreme at every turn. This year they staged a satanic escape room alongside all the films. And that was... have you guys done an escape room?
Yeah, I did one. Was this one designed by Landon?
Yeah, so...
By Landon Zach. All right, so I did an escape room with Landon at Toronto, which was fun. But I would be... You know, he... Landon Zach is a programmer for Sundance and does a lot of stuff for some other film festivals. And he is a fiend for escape rooms, like a genuine addict, and loves them and is intent on creating his own. And I did one with him, and it was a lot of fun to go through it in Toronto and just sort of hear, as my first time through, about what he felt were the pros and cons of this escape room and what he might do differently and his thoughts about how to get through it. I would love to do one that he designed. So tell me.
Well, Dave should also speak here because Dave did the Stanley Film Fest experience, which Landon also created.
That is correct. That was a Landon creation.
Yeah, and that was very immersive, right?
Yeah, well, the year that I did it was, oh God, it might be the last year it's ever done at this point, but some stuff went wrong because they reached like capacity of number of people, which was really interesting just as somebody who was as interested in the game as the mechanics of the game, just to see that, you know, start off really strong and then sort of peter out by no fault of the game maker himself. So escape room sounds much more controllable.
Well, yeah, it almost feels like it's interesting. David, what you're describing when you're hearing all this is Fantastic Fest owning the fact that it's an experience festival, not a film festival. And the things that surround it that people can't shut up about are the cinema adjacent experiences, which I think click right in with the movies you're watching. In the lobby of the Draft House, there were a couple of VR displays, which one of them was you lay in a coffin and put on a VR helmet and you get cremated. Cool. God. That's fucked up. Great. I loved it. And then you have this panic room, which I found I'd never done one before, and other people may think this is obvious, but the panic room was a deeply cinematic experience. For me, it felt like living... It felt like living Mist, or it felt like living... I saw a movie later in the day called The Autopsy of Jane Doe, which is a Brian Cox, Emile Hirsch movie directed by the guy who did Troll Hunter, where they spend most of the time in an autopsy performing this this operation.
That sounds rough.
What? No, it's actually
great.
Really entertaining. It's like Hammer horror. It's very exaggerated, but they're performing this autopsy, finding clues throughout and moving around this room. And I recalled my experience in the Satanic Panic Room where I was, you know, well... I can't really say because it's still going on through October, and I actually signed an NDA about what I did in the room.
Wow.
But it did involve getting chained up in the beginning and kind of working my way through the room with three other people, unlocking the chains, solving different puzzles, and working together in this space and having a countdown clock and a lot of satanic imagery and sounds coming through the room. And it felt very immersive and cinematic to me. And then seeing that in other movies, I feel there's a direct connection. And we talk a lot about it on the podcast, too, like how other mediums can be filmic, I don't know, or like movies. And I think Fantastic Fest is nailing that with the Panic Room or the Itch.io concert or what they do. Now, this isn't as cinematic, but I went to the Fantastic Debates. Have you guys heard of these?
Being
broadcast this year. Two guys from the Draft House debated if Rocky IV was the greatest boxing movie of all time. The guy who thinks it is did not have a very good argument, although he did say that the Cold War ended around the time Rocky IV came out, so you can connect the dots there. But then, you know, they have this debate, and then they actually punch each other, which is a raucous time. But that also feels connected to the movies you're watching. I also saw a Scott Adkins action movie called Boyka Undisputed. I don't know if you are familiar with Scott Adkins, the kind of Jean-Claude Van Damme, or he was a student of his, or at least working with him in this stunt group, and now he's broken off and become a direct-to-DVD hero, a star, and this is his big franchise. It's an MMA franchise. Horrible movie. Hated it. It's just Scott Adkins punching people in an MMA ring for, you know, an hour, plus some bad Ukrainian accents. But I don't know. I saw a connection between the debates and this movie. That's what I think Fantastic Fest does really well, and why people can't shut up about it, because they're seeing what they see in the movies come to life around the experience, between beers, of course.
Like a film festival theme park.
Yes, it's exactly that. And I don't think that's lesser, well, because I got into some serious debates, not boxing debates, but close, with people about what we do here in New York and some of these other festivals, about how they're very self-serious, and, you know, there's a divide between what Fantastic Fest does and programs versus what other, you know, the New York Film Festival. Oh, why doesn't anyone from New York ever come to Fantastic Fest? Well, because it's so it's serious.
The
it's
reason
serious
that anymore. No one goes to Fantastic Fest is because it's right during the New York Film Festival.
That was one of my arguments. That's one of my arguments.
Which is one, I, you know, despite my sort of devil's advocate argument, I reiterate what I said at the start of the segment, which is that Fantastic Fest sounds like a lot of fun, and every year I'm more inclined to go. But you would have to, as my boss just did, have to take a few days out of the New York Film Festival screenings in advance of the fest to go to Fantastic Fest. And if you've gone to Telluride in Toronto, that's a lot easier. But it's still, that's one of the reasons a lot of people from New York don't go.
Well, I could
also,
see
if
you
you're
coming.
In the media, like Fantastic Fest seems really fun to attend, but in terms of reading about it, like who wants, I don't want to read about it. I want to go.
Well, you wouldn't, you could read about the movies. You could read about.
Sure. Know. But like, there's not much of an incentive for a lot of media outlets to cover it, I guess is my.
That is definitely true. That is definitely true. But that's not a good excuse not to attend, which is the case
really
I finally
fun
made.
To attend. Like, I'd love to go personally.
That's the jump I made this year. I was like, I'm probably not going to write too much about this, but it was a lot of fun. But it's interesting, too, because it's not necessarily the setting for every movie or the perfect setting. I saw Arrival at the festival, and I'm going to see it again. I enjoyed it quite a bit. But lot of people were elated by it.
Does it do a Prisoners?
It's better than Prisoners. It's better than Prisoners. David, you saw it, right?
All right.
I don't
want
to get too deep into it now, but.
Yeah, we are going to have several conversations, yeah. I am sure, about Arrival.
Oh, great.
If there is never. It's hard to think of any other movie we've covered on this segment that more that more obviously needs a.
Hour long.
A two part discussion.
Yeah,
a little
absolutely.
Bit of a.
Well, so.
For people
yeah,
well,
then
I want to do.
Seeing this one too.
Yeah.
And for people who haven't. I think that Fantastic Fest is an audience that is perfectly geared towards appreciating Arrival.
Oh, no. It's not about the audience at all. It's actually about the Drafthouse experience. And
which is the sound and everything
yes,
else?
Yes, because when you get going and people are still coming to theaters and then you have the waiters and then this was the premiere of the whole festival.
Oh,
so it was especially animated. And before the movie, they had people come in dressed as aliens and spacemen and doing a big dance number. It was wild. It was fun. But there was a lot of moving around as the film kind of came to life.
So that distracted from it?
Yeah, it just took a little bit away. It's such a quiet movie and it's such a – it's not like a wild alien adventure or something.
I you know, I agree completely with what you're saying. Just because I've seen it, I know what you mean by quiet. It is with the Johan Johansson score. It is a very, very loud
yes.
movie as well. But
well, I just want to say that to wrap this up too. Like on the antithesis of that.
I have two very specific kaiju checking questions for you, Mr.
Okay,
Padgett.
Yes. That's very Fantastic Fest of you, and good questions asked for good movies that play at the Draft House. So go.
Okay, number one, you got to see Colossal. We heard about it last week. The Anne Hathaway is a drunken monster in Korea, maybe, movie.
That is,
what
that
you
is right. You have the premise correct. I liked it more than David, which I believe David's summation was utter garbage, and Nacho Vigalondo is a terrible, terrible filmmaker. I believe that was the...
And person.
Okay.
No, I kid. No, it has some redeeming things about it, and I think the premise is fun.
The premise is definitely...
It was severely mishandled.
Yeah, it could always dig deeper, but I am an Anne Hathaway apologist, and I am giddy for the setup, as you mentioned, Dave, the connection between someone in kind of upstate New York and then, you know, this monster in South Korea. Takes some interesting turns, but I don't know. It's polarizing. I know some people who really, really enjoyed it. I just couldn't kind of latch onto the metaphor enough, or maybe the filmmakers couldn't. But, yeah.
All right. So I'm going to reserve judgment on that just because I'm like big monster movies, which also means I should ask you if you got to see Shin Godzilla, which had
I
its
didn't.
American
it hasn't
premiere.
It hasn't played yet. I came home too early, but that one will be playing in New York, too. I think they're doing some Comic-Con stuff. So you should come home. and come see Godzilla. Back,
oh, also,
well, I already have
time...
my Denver tickets. We'll see. Maybe I'll do multiple Shin Godzillas.
Speaking of Dave coming to New York, next time we're all in one place, we're all doing an escape room together.
Yes, my wedding will actually be an escape.
Well, yeah, we're all going to escape from Batch's wedding.
Marriage is the ultimate escape room.
Yes. I have to give one shout out, Fantastic Fest shout out to a movie that I would never, ever, ever, ever have seen, and I'm not sure if it's coming out. It's actually the guys from Mondo Video recovered this film called Jungle Trap, which was shot in 1990 by this B-movie exploitation director just as all the direct-to-DVD distributors were collapsing. And he did not. This film never came out. And these guys eventually connected with him because they found another one of his lost films and kind of restored that and put that out. And they, when they went to his house, he's like, oh, here's another lost film. You ever heard of this one? And they're like, give it to us. So they restored Jungle Trap, which was shot on video, looks like garbage. They gave it a score. They kind of trimmed it and put it back together and they aired it at Fantastic Fest and it was a riot. This is just what you love about The Room, but now that The Room is overblown and played to death, Jungle Trap kind of fits that bill, and it seems more authentic because it has it struggles to have production value. You know, it's about these archaeologists going into the jungle to find ancient Mali amulets and that sort of thing. And it's terrible. It's terrible. And it was weird watching it with the director because you're laughing at the bad acting and the bad direction, and he's there. But maybe that's the sublime part, that these guys love this, his work so much, and just love the outsider art quality of it, that they can bring it back to life and he can appreciate it too. So that was a unique experience. So if there's one big reason to go to Fantastic Fest, it's nuggets like that. Things that may or may not come out, things that may or may not even hit VOD. This is just a labor of love for these guys. And I think that's what you feel, David, when you see people tweeting. It's a love, man. It's a love.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We won't have a review this week, but we'll all be watching the debate. So watch that instead of listening for our review. Participate in democracy.
Something tells me people don't want to hear our review of the debates. What do you think?
Oh my God.
I think the debates have happened. Oh, so everybody knows.
But yeah, watch the next one. How's that?
Perfect.
So we'll be back next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them, or you can leave comments or questions. We will read them. And we've had healthy discussions on there. It's actually quite wonderful. So fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together at Facebook. At Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, DA70. That's also my Twitter handle. I blog at geek.com and put my podcasts at fightinginthewarroom.com, like Pat just told you about. This week for Storm of Spoilers, we're going back to Star Wars territory because Rebels is back on the air and we're about to get a whole bunch of new product for Rogue One. So I want to talk about it. You should stay tuned for that on this feed. Yo.
And I'm Katie Rich. As of today, as you hear this, I am back at VanityFair.com, back in action. Parenting and working, I really can't have it all. So you can find me there and also on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, where all of us are on Twitter. At FITWR, talking to you and asking you about this week's lightning round question, which we will retweet when you answer it. What was it?
In honor of Deepwater Horizon, what news event during your lifetime should be Mark Wahlberg's next hero-making project?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.